From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
The gun issue has always been in the news and, sadly, always relevant. Our guest is Rick Smith, who founded Axon Technologies that pioneered taser technology with a vision of making the bullet obsolete. He also happens to have a riveting personal story, having lost two friends to gun violence, shot and killed. He resolved to find better options through technology and tackle this subject in his new book, The End of Killing: How Our Newest Technologies Can Solve Humanity's Oldest Problem. He says that technology will make killing a thing of the past. Smith argues that our skepticism about new technologies and their potential is what holds us back from making an overdue and necessary shift in our attitudes about weapons. He joins us now by phone to discuss these arguments. Rick Smith, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, good morning. Great to be here.
Well, good morning. It's great to have you on the program. Before we talk about the book, if you could start at the beginning, how and why you got involved with taser technology.
Yeah, I was living in Europe when two of my friends were shot and killed by a businessman who had a gun that was legitimate, that he owned for self-defense. And the three of them ended up in an altercation, and now they're both dead, and the shooter is spending his life in prison. And it really struck me that this was potentially a triple tragedy. I'm sure that man didn't get out of bed wanting to be a murderer, but ultimately, that's where he's ending up now. His life is ruined, and it struck me that it's just bizarre that in today's day and age, we are defending ourselves with a medieval technology. I mean, firearms have been around for hundreds of years, and the light bulb that went off for me was that the way to solve the violence problem, and violence with guns in particular, is to invent our way out of it and to create better systems that could allow somebody like that man to protect himself, but without literally blowing holes in other people and killing them.
And it's an antiquated technology, as you say, medieval, but at the same time, the way these bullets and guns are made, if you get shot with a gun today, it's not going to end up good. These guns are so destructive, and taser is a way of stopping somebody versus killing them or maiming them for life. Is that correct?
That's true. I try to be very clear that the non-lethal weapons like the taser that are out there today are not yet a suitable replacement for a firearm. They're just not as reliable yet. But as I lay out in the book, the path to get there, we've seen enough in the science and in the data to know that it is doable. And I believe within the next 10 years that we can advance these less lethal technologies to the point where they're actually performing as well or better in terms of immediately stopping a threat, but doing it in a way where, let's say after a police officer shoots someone and they discover that that was a cell phone in their hand, not a gun, that they can pick this person up, dust them off, and everybody goes about their life. It's just an incredible tragedy to me, particularly for law enforcement officers whose primary tool of the trade is the gun. And so the point of this book was to begin the conversation, because this is a big mind shift to think about what happens when the gun is no longer the apex at the top of the defensive pyramid, and we can break the link between killing and protecting oneself. That's why I wanted to start talking about it now, so that the world would be ready in the next 10 years as we approach that point.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Rick Smith. His new book is The End of Killing: How Our Newest Technologies Can Solve Humanity's Oldest Problem. And part of what you're saying, Rick, is that we're slow to embrace new technologies. And, it's probably been only the last 10 years that term disruptive technology has even been thrown around. And yet, if you look at the taser technology, I believe the first, the original inventor of taser was back in the early 70s. And it was a disruptive technology. But when it comes to making bullets obsolete, why haven't we gotten there yet? And is it our lack of embracing this disruption?
Yeah, well, I would say in general, we actually do a pretty good job. I mean, tech is moving really fast now, but it's typically in things that are low networking and general like use of computers in IT. Where I think we're too slow is in high-risk areas, and I believe that's where we need technology the most. So, for example, when one of the reasons the original Taser didn't make it in the 1970s, it ran into some legal and regulatory problems, and investors, just seeing all the risk associated with it, lost interest. And then as I created this company, we faced tremendous headwinds. We've been through hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits, tremendous negative publicity, because it's no conspiracy, but what it is that we're used to the way the world is, and when you truly introduce something radical, particularly something like shooting someone with electricity to stop them, it's sort of a very strange and controversial concept. And my point I'm trying to make in the book is we've got to pause, take a step back, and then compare it to what do we do when we don't have this new electric technology? Oh, that's right. We fall back to blowing holes in people with flaming or flying, shrapnel. So I think it's important that as we look at the most dangerous parts of society where we need the most innovation, and that's where the technology is not the biggest hurdle. It's the public acceptability.
One of the things that you say early on in your book is that you welcome criticism and critical review and people who disagree with you. And this is such a sensitive subject, talking about bullets and or making bullets obsolete. What are the biggest criticisms of your approach?
Well, what I've, obviously online, you tend to get some really unvarnished and perhaps even aggressive feedback. I'd say the most negative feedback has come from folks who have not read the book, who see the title and the cover and end up posting things like, oh, this guy just wants to take our guns away, and sort of that anti-gun rant, which
paranoid.
Couldn't be further from the truth. I bought my dad a gun for his birthday one year. I understand, the Second Amendment, people's right to arms. My point is purely, we can give people something better and they can have a choice. Much like, New York City in the early 1900s had a huge problem with horse manure. It was causing disease and all sorts of problems in the city. If you tried to take people's horses away, they would have revolted. But of course, we gave them horseless carriages and the world moved on. I think it's the same thing here. Some people have a very close affinity with their guns. But the job of industry and inventorship is to give them something better and where they don't end up like that gun owner who defended himself with his gun and is now spending his life in prison. No gun owner wants that. If we can give them a better tool that's more effective and protects them from the legal aftermath of killing someone, I believe most people, the market forces will work, and most people will choose to go this direction instead.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Rick Smith. He founded Axon Technologies. It's the company that pioneered Taser with the vision of making the bullet obsolete. He's written the book, The End of Killing, How Our Newest Technologies Can Solve Humanity's Oldest Problem. Rick, I just want to toss this out. I mean, this might be an opportunity for the NRA. The NRA is under a lot of fire. Its viewership, I understand, is down. I don't know that for sure. I just heard that anecdotally. If they are under fire, they could embrace this as something and reinvent themselves, couldn't they?
That is a really interesting insight. To date, I've been pretty careful to try to avoid getting into the politics of gun control, because specifically that we want to stay out of that issue. You can, our vision is something that can appeal to the biggest gun lover and the biggest gun control advocate. So I've been a bit careful to just stay out of that issue. I'm not a politician, and that's not one I can resolve. But I do think your point is interesting that, the NRA really at its core is about protecting people's rights to defend themselves. And in fact, the Second Amendment has been used in several states that had outlawed stun guns, where the NRA and the Second Amendment preserve those people's rights to defend themselves with non-lethal force. So I think intellectually, it's a great fit. I'll have to think about that. I've just so far, like I said, I've been really careful. I don't want to get mired into the debate over guns when really what I'm talking about is what comes next.
Well, I would think you get someone else to take that on for you. I mean, the way I look at it is it's a cultural problem. It's a communication problem. It's a constitutional problem, although Second Amendment, I think you could get past that. And inherently, humans, we've learned, maybe we don't want to really admit it, but we are really a violent animal. And that's not going to change. And I like your thoughts that you can't legislate violence just like you can't legislate abstinence for teen sex. I mean, that freight train's left the station and it's not going to stop. So there's got to be a way to do this. And I think the NRA could be a partner in this.
That's a really interesting insight. The one thing I would say that surprised me as I was writing the book was on this topic of mankind being violent. As I dug in, I don't know if you've heard of Steven Pinker, Harvard psychologist.
Yes,
and,
of course.
Really enlightening and exciting when I read his book about the overall declines in violence, that, humanity has become basically almost 500 times less violent than it used to be in terms of the rates of homicide. I mean, we used to, in medieval times, people killing each other wasn't, a regular occurrence. And now it's really become, we don't see the major, industrialized wars like we saw in the last century. We see homicide rates are down dramatically from where they were a few hundred years ago. So the optimist in me says, I think humanity, I have no urge to go hurt and kill anyone. And that's true of the vast majority of people. We just have these edge cases where we do have some violent folks, and then the only way to stop them is to become uber violent yourself. And that's what police have to do when they use lethal force. And I think, what I'm doing is I view that I'm standing on the shoulders of the trend that Professor Pinker has identified and trying to look at, okay, how do we continue to whittle away at where we still kill each other and solve it there?
Well, as Steven Pinker does, getting at the core of what violence is about, is violence about control? Is violence about asserting dominance? Or if violence is really about self-defense, then your argument makes absolute sense. If it's really about self-defense, then let's use taser technology and not go around killing people.
Yeah, great point. And on those other topics, one of the reasons we changed the name from Taser to Axon was we were the market leader in body cameras, which we did precisely because of those other concerns about our police using this as an overt means of oppression and control, or they misusing these weapons. And obviously, transparency can be a pretty powerful tool against oppression.
Right. So when you bring up this, this very simple point that you're making is that bullets kill. Let's make bullets obsolete. Let's go around the problem instead of going into recreating gun laws and things like that. And let's save those 12-year-olds who are just walking down the street with a hoodie on, carrying a cell phone, who get shot and killed by police. But on the other hand, there is that argument that everyone will come up that will say, well, the criminals will still have guns. And so how do you solve that problem?
Yeah, I think, so first of all, I've had some really interesting discussions with police officers who say, wait a minute, I don't want to take a taser to a gunfight. And that's true today, but it's true today because today's weapons are not as effective and reliable. But if you had Captain Kirk's phaser from Star Trek, where it was 100% reliable and immediate, it dropped in stunning the subject to the ground, then what is the justification for killing them with a technology that performs worse at stopping the threat? I mean, many times people get shot with bullets and they can return fire for 10, 15, 20 seconds. So it's really interesting. Once you dig in there, the police will actually agree, Yeah, we are not public executioners. Our job is not to carry out a death sentence. Our job when we're using lethal force is because it's the thing that will best stop the threat. And so I think we're approaching a really interesting world where, yes, if the non-lethal weapon is indeed more effective, you would use it even if the enemy or the other person has a lethal weapon. Now, there's other things I go into in the book, for example, using drones to deploy from greater distances. So if someone does have a gun, you just don't get up next to them in the first place. It's not just don't take a taser to a gunfight. Don't take a gun to a gunfight. Don't get in a gunfight. Like, being near somebody who can shoot you with a gun is a super risky scenario to be in. So I think there's some ways we can use automation, which was one of the reasons I put all the disclaimers in the book, because I wanted to put out some of the more controversial ideas. And when you talk about drones armed with non-lethal weapons, that's fairly controversial. And that's probably been the thing I've been most shocked about, is the positive response across the board from you know, journalists on the left and cops on the right. In fact, this weekend I'm co-presenting with the mayor from Parkland, Florida, at the National Conference of Mayors. We're going to be talking about school safety. And one of the ideas we're talking about is, what if instead of like planting cops at every school, what if we planted series of pre-emplaced small robots or drones the police could operate? You could get much more coverage, and you avoid the problem that we saw in Parkland, where the officer, you know, out of fear and self-preservation or for whatever reason, didn't go in after the threat. When you can use automated systems, that does introduce a whole bunch of control challenges that we could go very deep on. But ultimately, if the police could send in a drone and take out a shooter, you could do it far faster without requiring anyone to put their life at risk, compared to, you know, asking a teacher to tote a gun and go confront a threat.
I have to admit, when I first heard about your book and making bullets obsolete, I said, I just wasn't sure. And then, of course, I took a look at the book, and this all is really starting to make sense to me. And the whole notion of solving it with technology, why don't you talk about how, you know, how we tackled AIDS and some of these other things, and why this approach could help us using technology?
When I talk about technology, I think today we tend to think, oh, tech, you know, iPhones and apps. No, I'm using the broader definition of technology, which is human inventiveness. And in that respect, technology is the thing that has solved every major problem that we have solved, whether it's running water and sewage in cities in, you know, in centuries past, up to, you know, whether it's the telephone or the television or the internet, or clean running water, go to medicine, right? We didn't solve AIDS by banning sex. We did it through a combination of public policy, but the real, for teaching safe sex and condoms, et cetera. But the biggest shift has been the advancements in medical technology, to where now we can pretty effectively suppress the disease and hopefully one day cure it altogether. And I think this is just a great analogy that really difficult problems typically aren't solved through political solutions so much as technological advances. And this is an area where I think we've been far too dependent on the political solution to say, well, we don't like this technology of guns, so let's just take it away. And then on the other side, all the arguments against that. And I think, it's been great. Once I've talked with people about this, the logic seems to be compelling, that people get it, that, well, wait a minute, rather than fighting over the politics of who can have what, we need to invent the next thing that just sort of makes the problem go away.
Beyond tasers, as you mentioned, Axon also has body-worn cameras, and you're leading the market there. But I also believe you have in-car police cameras, evidence management software solutions, sensors, and some AI services. I'm curious, what percentage of all of your businesses is, we'll just break them all down, but I was specifically interested in what percentage of your business is taser?
So today, Taser is about half the business, and the other half is made up of cameras and software. And we do everything from drones with a partnership with DJI to in-car cameras, wearable cameras, and a host of services, including AI. Today, by the way, was a pretty big day for us. We formed an AI ethics board to help us navigate these issues. One of the trickier technologies today is facial recognition. It is quite controversial, we formed this ethics board to help us, knowing that every technology police can use carries a risk of abuse, and we want to make sure we design things in a way that we're being very careful to minimize the risk of abuse. So our board recommended that we not do facial recognition at this time, and we publicly have announced we're going to follow that recommendation, that until facial recognition is both more accurate, more racially equitable in terms of its accuracy, and we need to really understand what sort of controls we want to put in place, because I think we all agree we don't want the police scanning our face everywhere we go and tracking us, you know, every second of the day. But on the other hand, we probably want them able to identify if the next, you know, Osama bin Laden is, you know, sauntering through an airport. So obviously there's two real edge cases. The point is that with these new technologies, because public acceptance is the key barrier, we think it's really important to sometimes, for the technologists like us, to slow down and make sure we really understand the public acceptability factor before rolling a technology out. Because if it goes wrong, it can go really wrong.
Well, I applaud that decision that you all made as ethicists. But I'm curious, for current technology, doesn't technology do a better job than human beings in facial recognition?
Yeah, that's kind of a loaded question. It depends on the circumstances. Generally speaking, if you're out in the wild, a cop out on the street, wearing a body camera, the lighting conditions, the cameras are moving. Our assessment is that the accuracy rate would be low enough that you'd get false positives. And if the technology instigates the officer into a heightened state of alert and something bad happens, that could be pretty catastrophic. So we don't think, certainly for our application, the technology would not be past human performance. And in particular, there are some really legitimate issues that, today's facial recognition algorithms do not perform as well across the races and the sexes. And that creates real concerns out of communities of color about this technology impacting them unevenly. And so, again, we didn't say we're not going to do this. What we've said is we're not going to commercialize it and that we're going to take our time so that before we roll it out, we really understand, okay, what could go wrong and how have we mitigated against that?
Rick, you wrap up your book, The End of Killing, with a chapter on how this theory, the relationship to the war on drugs. Can you take us through how making bullets obsolete can affect the war on drugs?
Yeah, so this was a chapter I did a lot of soul searching about including. But, as I was putting together my arguments, the goal of the book was to talk about how do we get people to stop killing each other. Mm-hmm. And when we also talk about facial recognition and AI, we have to confront uneven policing in the U.S., where clearly we do arrest more people of color than not. And one of the issues that kept popping up was the war on drugs. And in particular, we've talked about how the world is becoming less and less violent. In the United States, there are pockets that remain quite violent. And in particular, we have a subculture where violence is actually a logical choice to make, and that is in the illicit drug trade. So if someone decides to become a drug dealer or participate in that trade, you effectively have now stepped out of the world that we all live in where we can call the government to protect our interests. You can't because you're breaking the law. And in that black market, you must defend your rights through the use of violence. Actually, Steven Pinker had a great analogy that inner cities where drug trafficking is rampant, they're very similar to the street honor code is very similar to the medieval honor code of ancient Europe, which is thou must protect your honor and your interest through the use of violence. And so as I looked at this, first of all, I said, well, if we want to end killing, we should look at, do we have policies that are actually counterproductive and are perpetuating violence? And I believe in that respect, the drug war does. And the other piece of evidence that I found just super compelling is it's not working. We declared the war on drugs in 1971. Since that time, tobacco use has plummeted. So what we've done from public education, public policy on tobacco has really worked well. And yet this much more aggressive war footing on drugs has not. Drug use has either stayed flat or increased. And the price of this war has been we've incarcerated nearly 1 million Americans. We've enforced that law much more unevenly on poor communities and communities of color. And ultimately, we've created these ecosystems that perpetuate violence. So I've looked at that and agree with thinkers like Richard Branson that if it ain't working and it actually has a huge cost, part of that cost is the terrible violence that ensues. I think it was incumbent on me to step up and say something, and especially because, look, my customers are all in law enforcement. This was a little bit risky because many police would not agree with my position. But I think, good friends speak open and honestly to each other, and the data was just screaming to me that we should really rethink our policy, and I think we should shift from the war on drugs to public policy measures like we've used on tobacco that are both effective and without all the costs and side effects.
Mm. I've got to switch gears on you here for just a second because I want to make sure I get the chance to ask you about self-inflicted violence and suicide. And locally here in the Salt Lake Valley, there was a rash of teenage suicides. And in the period of time of about 4 months, about five kids took their lives, and they all did so by breaking into either their parents' or a relative's gun closet or whatever you'd call it. None of those guns were secured to the point that they weren't able to reach them. And I'm just wondering what you think about that. I mean, obviously, it's suicide is a huge issue in our country, especially among our young people. And if were they not, being that suicide is often a crime of passion, and it happens very immediately, were they not able to access guns, it may cut down on those suicides.
I've certainly, heard arguments. In fact, I believe there was a study that looked at cross-border suicide rates between Vancouver and Seattle, with guns being much more prevalent on one side of the border, and that they can make a difference. I would say that's one where suicide in and of itself is probably outside the scope of the issue as I'm going at it. So I'm not as much of an expert there, but I do know, like in general, candidly, we don't have a gun in my house, even though, as I said, I've been comfortable with guns. I gave my father one. We've had a gun suicide within, close circle of friends and family. And in our case, one thing that, as I look at it, a gun is an incredibly powerful device. And as human beings, we make mistakes and we get emotional. And, if we have kids and teens going through those things, there's a lot of unpredictability, and having something with that awesome power around, if something goes wrong, it can be horrific. And so from a risk management perspective in our household, we do have tasers, but we've elected not to have guns because the risk of a bad event. And I think even any pro-gun trainer or expert would tell you, if you're going to have a gun in the house, you absolutely need to, put in the right security procedures, like a biometric gun safe where those things are locked up, so people can't get to them.
Right. And that makes me wonder about self-defense and tasers. How many people currently, can we at this point have tasers in our homes for self-defense?
Yes. Yeah, we probably have 600,000 to 700,000 consumer tasers have been sold in the U.S.
Rick Smith, he founded Axon Enterprises. It's the company that pioneered the taser. He has the vision of making the bullet obsolete. His new book, The End of Killing, How Our Newest Technologies Can Solve Humanity's Oldest Problem. Rick, this has been an interesting conversation.
Thanks. I've really enjoyed it. And it's been thought-provoking for me as well. Your concepts about the NRA are quite interesting. I'm going to be noodling on that all day.
I'm going to think about it a little bit more myself and maybe send you some mail, but I think you're onto something, and I thank you for joining us this morning.
Great.
Thanks,
anytime.
Rick.
I appreciate you taking the time to air the ideas.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.